Okay, so we began last week with the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri, and we didn't really get to much of the rebellion itself that we'll discuss this week. The goal, I think we might actually finish, don't hold me to this, we might finish a little bit early today. We'll finish the rest of the parak, and then going to take an opportunity to really take a step back and look at a 50,000 foot view after we finish the parak, because the truth is, the whole there's a massive chunk of Shmuel Beis from the beginning of David and Bathsheba through Avshalom, and now the culmination of that whole rebellion process is really Sheva ben Bichri. I think it'll be very productive to kind of look at the whole big unit and see what lessons we have, not just from the specific parak itself, but now that we will have Rosh Hashem gone through the sin, the punishment, and everything else, see maybe what a couple of new perspectives we might have that we didn't necessarily find ourselves in the position to have as we were going parak by parak. So we'll start with picking up from last week, right? So we had the first half of Parak Chaf, where in the aftermath of the Avshalom rebellion, David trying to put the pieces back together. We saw there were really four different factions that Bnei Yisrael find themselves in. Yehuda is one, Binyamin is one, the northern tribes is a third, and the tribes on the other side of the Eber HaYarden is a fourth. And David is trying to bring these back together. And he finds himself in an impossible position. He bends over backwards to bring Yehuda, his own Shevet, back into his coalition, but that then alienates the northern tribes. So Sheva ben Bichri gets up and he issues the cry, which Bnei Yisrael are going to repeat in 40, 50 years, whatever it's going to be, after the death of Shlomo, when the 10 tribes rebel against Rehavam, right? Every man of Israel back to his tent. And the Abarbanel had a very, very important insight, which we'll really delve into some more today, that Sheva ben Bichri does not seem to have tried to set himself up as a king. His goal really was political anarchy, just abolishing the monarchy entirely and returning to the world of the Shoftim. And then most of the time we spent, the truth was not on Sheva ben Bichri, but on David and Yoav, and how the two of them really seem to fall into the same mistake of, you know, taking their personal preference and then finding official justifications for that, right? So first David did that in terms of firing Yoav as the head of the army. There were good political reasons why one could maybe want to do such a thing. Choosing Amasa as a general who was the favorite of Sheva Yehuda. You know, he just goes from one nephew to another, but he goes with the nephew who was loyal to Avshalom, who seems to be a real partisan of Sheva Yehuda. At the same time, Mufarshim, while we're pointing out, the real reason why David is firing Yoav is because he's angry at him for having killed Avshalom, which the Navi seems pretty clear to be confident was the correct thing that Yoav had done. And then Yoav takes that one step, several steps farther, where he goes and assassinates Amasa again. Yoav can put forth good official reasons for wanting to do that. Gemara says that Yoav identified Amasa as a Moriv Malchus. Rav Amnon Bazak suggested that Amasa actually was once again rebelling against David to explain why he mysteriously found himself in the middle of Givon in the land of Binyamin when he is supposed to be recruiting the army from Yehuda. We suggest really more along the lines of what the Dan Mikra also suggests, that Asael was actually trying, not Asael, that Amasa was actually maybe trying to negotiate with Shevet Binyamin, which is the Shevet of Sheva ben Bichri. But Yoav, in his haste and rush and anger, misidentifies the situation and instead assassinates Amasa. The Navi is pretty critical of Yoav for that. And we saw just this incredible contrast between the behavior of the army here, where Yoav disembowels Amasa in the middle of the road, exceptionally graphic, and the army is horrified, right? They won't move on. And it was contrasted with two different episodes that happened in Shmuel Beis. The first, when the same exact thing happened to Asael, the brother of Yoav, And in that case, Yoav and Avishai charged on, and they're able to inspire the people to come with them, right? This time, Yoav and Avishai try again to charge ahead, but this time the people do not follow. And then the second parallel was, so what happened with Absalom? When the random Ish, the anonymous Ish, had discovered Absalom hanging from the tree, and he told Yoav about it. Yoav was upset with the anonymous Ish and said, why'd you leave him there? I'll take care of things myself. And Yoav ran ahead and killed Absalom, which put an end to the war. In that case, it was Yoav's action in contrast with the anonymous Ish, which really was the correct course of action. But here, when Yoav kills Amasa, that destroys, that completely undermines his whole army. And it takes the anonymous Na'ar, one of Yoav's lads, to cover up Amasa. And then the anonymous lad inspires the rest of the army to keep going. Right, so it was pretty clear that the Navi was critical both of David in terms of firing Yoav, putting the personal in ahead of the, let's say, political or what's, you know, right for the country, and Yoav doing the same thing. So now we shift to the war itself. And what's going to be really interesting for Yoav is that even though the Navi is pretty critical of Yoav in the first half of the Barak, we'll see, I think, that Yoav really, I don't want to say redeems himself, because David and Shlomo and Sefer Melachim do not think that Yoav redeemed himself, but Yoav is, definitely turns it around in the second half of the parak. So the truth is, we technically left off in Pasuk Yadalit, but Yadalit is a bit of a difficult pasuk to understand. The Mefarshim disagree how to read it, and it'll be better for us to have context. So I'm just going to scroll up for a second. So the previous pasuk, right? So this is when the after Amasa has been buried. So the pasuk said, "Kasher hogam in hamasila." After Amasa was removed from the road, "Avar kol ish acharei Yoav." Right, every man followed Yoav. "Lardov acharei Sheva ben Bichri." So now the rest of the army is following Yoav to chase after Sheva ben Bichri. So now, with that in mind, the pasuk of Gimel is, the army is following Yoav to chase Sheva. We can look at Pasuk Yudalad and we'll see why the Mefarshim disagree how to understand it. The next Pasuk was, Vayavor b'chol shivtei Yisrael. He traveled through the Shvatim. The question is, who is he? Is he Yoav, who was the subject of the previous Pasuk? Yoav is the one who is chasing after Sheva. So is Pasuk Yudalad telling us that Yoav is going through Shivtei Yisrael? Or is it Sheva ben Bichri, right? Where was Sheva ben Bichri going? Maybe it's Sheva ben Bichri of our Bechol Shivtei Yisrael. Avela u'beis macha, right? Towards Avel beis macha, Bechol ha-beirim, which Rashi says he does not know what that actually is. Vaykalu, vayavo acharel. And then they gathered and they came after him. Once again, who's gathering, who's coming? Are people gathering after Sheva ben Bichri, or are people gathering after Yoav? So there are three understandings in the Mefarshim. Rashi thinks that this is talking about Sheva ben Bichri, that the focus shifts to Sheva. Sheva is running through Shivtei Yisrael, trying to get them to give him support as king, right? Which assumes that Sheva wants to be set up as king. We saw Barbanel did not read Sheva's intent that way. And according to Rashi, Sheva is pretty successful because Vayikalo Vayvo Acharav. As he runs north, he is gathering supporters. That's how Rashi understands Pasuk Yudalad. I'm just going to scroll up to the top for a second to go to the map, which I put at the top of the source sheet. You can see how far exactly Sheva is running. Here's land of Yehuda. Here's Sheva ben Yamin. So here is the hometown of Sheva ben Bichri. And he is going to the extreme north of Eretz Yisrael, right? The borders of Eretz Yisrael army, Dan va'ad Be'er Sheva. Well, here's Dan and here's Be'er Sheva. So Avel Beis Macha, in modern day Lebanon, this is not part of Israel nowadays, is in the extreme north. So Sheva is going all the way to the north. Rashi would have to explain if he is trying to get, he's running through all the Shvatim, trying to get people to support him, it was a little weird that he would end up at the very northern tip of the country. So that's how Rashi understands what's going on. The Radak kind of splits the pasuk.
The Bar Manel calls him. The Bar Manel doesn't understand why he would do that. But one big problem that Rashi has is that Rashi reads the pasuk here as Sheva ben Bechri collecting a large army, right? Sheva goes through all of the Shvatim, Vaykalu, Vaybo, Acharav, and many people go after Sheva ben Bechri. Well, the problem is going to be in the next pasuk, Sheva ben Bechri is going to be holed up in one city. So where's the huge army that Sheva gathers to himself? So the Radak says, no, read the pasuk a little bit differently. The first half of the pasuk is talking about Sheva, like Rashi suggested, right? That Sheva is running through all of the Shvatim. But then the second half of the pasuk is talking about Yoav, that all the people are gathering after Yoav, chasing after Sheva ben Bechri. That's the second way. Now, Bar Manel and Rabbeinu Yeshaya have what seems to me to be the easiest shot in the pasuk. It just fits the context of what's happening before and happening after. And this is important for understanding what Yoav is going to do, that no point in this pasuk is referring to Sheva. The protagonist in this pasuk, just like in the previous pasuk and just like in the next pasuk, is Yoav ben Tzrui. Right? And the whole army came after Yoav. That was pasuk Yudgimel. Now Yoav goes with full Shiftei Yisrael. He's marching through the entire country, chasing after Sheva. And as Yoav marches through the country, he is gathering more and more people too. Right? So according to the Bar Manel's read, according to Ben Yeshaya's read, the rebellion does not seem to be doing very well. Sheva ben Bechri, the reason why he's all the way up north is because he's running. You know, he's not getting the support he would like to get. Yoav, after the Amasa disaster, has turned things around. People are flocking to the army. They recognize strength. They recognize a winner, and they're coming after him. Then we have Pasuk Tesvav. Vayavo vayetzur alav. Right. So they came. They besieged him. And you can see the. It's just it's very hard to. Why are we switching back and forth? Alav is obviously Sheva ben Bechri. How to tell when it's Sheva, when it's Yoav is very very hard to parse. Ba'avela beis macha. So then they're here, and you should get a sense of the action that the Navi is giving us. Yoav is, you know, very, very active here. Vayavo, they came. Vayatzu acharav, they besieged. Vayishbuchu solala el ha'ir. They poured a ramp against the city. What does that mean? I spent a little while last night trying to find a picture, but I didn't really have success. But this is very advanced siege technology. You know, they've come a long way. In the time of Sefer Yoshua, Bnei Yisrael could not really do a normal siege, right? They had two options. There's the Yericho model, where Hashem knocks down the walls for us. And then there was the Ai model, which Bnei Yisrael repeat throughout Sefer Yoshua, which is try to get the army out of the city, because if the army is in the city, Bnei Yisrael did not have the military ability to besiege a fortified city. Yoav, though, come a long way since then. He's able to do it. What does it mean to pour a ramp against the city? You have the city, which is up on a hill, then you have the wall. So it's very difficult to get your battering rams right up against the wall, because you got to schlep up this very steep hill in order to get there. So what you can do is, if you're able to literally build a ramp, it's just going to cut, you know, it's going to make it much easier. Instead of coming up the steep hill, you can, you know, just come this way, which gives you access to the wall. Now that requires very impressive engineering. That requires an army. That requires you to have the material, the equipment to be able to set up a ramp, even though presumably the people in Eva Beis Macha are probably shooting arrows against you. They're not probably so happy you're coming up against their wall. But Yoav, this is not his first rodeo. You know, he already conquered Rabbah Bnei Ammon. He already conquered the capital of Ammon. He's already defeated Edom. He's defeated Moab. So he's done this before. He can handle another city. Vatamod Bachel. So that's what the Navi means here. The people stood up against the wall, because now that they've built that ramp, they're able to access the wall itself. V'chol ha'ama, sheres Yoav, mashchisim lapil es hachoma. Now the entire army that's there with Yoav, they are battering down the wall, and they're going to knock it down. So the Navi gives, especially if you read it the way Bar Manel and Rabbeinu Yeshaya did, that Pasuk Yudal was also talking about Yoav, the Navi is getting an impression of really very, very strong, vigorous activity, right? Yoav is going, he's doing, he's gathering in an army,
they're besieging, they're pouring a ramp, they're building, they're up against the wall, they're destroying the wall, right? Action, 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 fighting, fighting, fighting. And everything is happening very, very quickly. Right? And we think of Yav, you know, like the general par excellence, we can see the one, it's just we've unleashed this juggernaut, and there's basically no way to stop it. And that's what makes Pasuk to Zion, and then Pasuk Yud Zion, really, really astonishing. And then all of a sudden, we have out of nowhere, about Dikra, Isha Chachama Min Ha'ir. There's a wise woman who calls out from the city. Modern Mepharshim points out we have yet another kind of link to the Avshalom rebellion, right? Avshalom, that whole narrative began with the Isha Chachama from Tekoa, who Yoav hired to come to Yerushalayim. Now we have a different Isha Chachama, who instead of working for Yoav, is going to try to negotiate with Yoav. And what does she say? You could hear the desperation in her voice. Shimu, shimu, imruna al Yoav krav ad hena va'adabra ena elath. Right? Listen, listen, tell Yoav, come here so I can talk to you. Okay, so all of a sudden, there's a ceasefire, right? The important thing, they listen to her. Va'krav elav, right? Yoav comes himself. Atom reisha, ata Yoav. Va'yomer ani. Atom relo, shema divrei amasecha, va'yomer shomea anochi. Right? This is a little bit funny. Why do we have this long introduction? It sounds like what the Isha Chachama is doing is that she's trying to slow things down. Right? There's been a building up and a building and building, fighting, 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 running, gathering, besieging. It's all happening in the blink of an eye. And the Isha Chachama, the first thing she's going to try to do is let's take a breath. Right? Let's take a time out. We're not going to negotiate in the heat of the moment, right? The Mishnah Perek Yavos that says you don't try to appease someone when he's angry. Well, you don't try to negotiate with Yoav when he is riding high on the fight. So we're going to slow things down. I'll call Yoav, and then Yoav comes to the wall. She doesn't right away give her proposal. She says, "Are you Yoav? I mean, come on. Who else am I? Yeah, I'm Yoav Ben Tzuria. You know, I'm the guy who's commanding. It's probably pretty clear." And she says, "You listening to me?" Yeah, he's listening. Okay. Now that she's gotten his attention, so this is hard to understand what exactly this means. Rashi have a very important comment. What do they translate here? They will want to speak an old time saying, right? So 1917 JPS translates this as Daber Yidabru Barishana. They used to say Sha'ol Yisha'alu Ba'evil. They shall ask for advice in Evel, v'chein heisamu. And that's how they ended the matter. So, wait, if you translate it that way, means that like Evel is a good place to come to for advice. Okay, but Rashi understands it differently. Rashi understands that the woman, and most of the Farshim follow Rashi, that the woman here is giving Yoav Musar. And that's boosted by Pasuk Yates, because in Pasuk Yates, she seems to pretty explicitly give him Musar, where she tells him, Atam evakesh lahamis ir ba'im b'Yisrael. Right? You're trying to destroy a very important city in Israel. Avo beis machas, really, it's a border city. You know, halacha is, if you have an ir hanidachas that's on the border, you don't destroy it, because the national security is too important. So this is a very, very important city. Lama tibala nachalas Hashem. Right? Why should you swallow up the inheritance of Hashem? This could refer to the city itself. It's possible. Maybe it could even refer to the surrounding area because of what's going to happen in the aftermath of this fortified city being destroyed. It opens it up to invasion from outside. So she's clearly giving him Musar and Pasuk Yud Tes. So Rashi understands that she's also giving him Musar and Yud Ches. Rashi says, Daber Daber Rishon Neimor, meaning, Hayala Chala Daber B'Shalom Rishon. You should have negotiated in the beginning. It doesn't mean, Avel Beis Macha is a place where people used to come for advice, like some, like, you know, lore or whatever. No, she's telling him, go back to those earlier psukim where, if you gather the army, you ran up to the wall, the blink of an eye, you're pouring the ramp, you're batting it down, you're being an amazing general if the goal is to conquer a city, but who says the goal is to conquer the city? What you should have done first is you should have opened up for negotiations. That's what, right? Sha'ol yishalu ba'eval. Im shalu b'nei chalcha b'shalom yirazel sh'sham ha'eval. You should have asked, right? You should have asked in Evel, and then v'chein haitamu. they would have answered you. They would have made peace, right? Tam, Yaakov, Yaakov ish Tam. They would have made peace. They would have made shalom with you. So this is just really, really interesting. I mean, here it is. It's almost like chutzpah, right? Ava Beis Macha takes in this rebel, Sheva ben Bichri. And then this woman, this Isha Chachama, gets up and she knows her customer. Yoav is not somebody who is going to listen to somebody who's just like a wilting, wallflower. You got to come in with confidence. You got to come in with some power behind your words. And she comes in giving him musav, saying, you should have negotiated with us. Now, to Yoav's infinite credit, and here Yoav and David HaMelech really share something in common, right? Because what's David's trademark characteristic? David will make mistakes, right? Especially in the heat of the moment. Now, there's a reason why when Shmuel Hanavi first saw the red, all the red face, he was alarmed. But the trademark David has is that almost without fail, when he's called out, he changes things. Now, when he has a second chance, when Nasan Havi comes along, he listens. When Yoav comes and yells at him, he listens. I think we've seen the only time so far he hasn't, that he's blown his second chance, is when he gave Mephibosheth's property to Tziva, the Eved, and then the second time around, instead of rectifying that, he split it 50-50. And that was the mistake that Chazal said is going to cost him 10 of the tribes going forward. Otherwise, whenever David makes a mistake, someone calls him out and he turns things around. Well, here, Yoav does exactly the same thing, right? It's the heat of the moment, the heat of the battle. He's gotten the army together. He's about to conquer. They've moved heaven and earth to get this far this quickly. But when Yoav hears the Musar, he as well turns around. Yan Yoav Ayamar, Chalila, Chalila Li, Im Avala Im Ashkes. Right? Chalila, Chalila, I don't want to do this. I'm not going to swallow. I'm not going to destroy. I mean, that was his plan, right? Literally, the battering rams are like right there. But immediately, he's going to change the ask. Lo kein hadavar ki yishmi har Ephraim sheva bebech rishmo. Right? I just want one man from Har Ephraim. It's interesting how Yoav says it, right? Why does he say ishmi har Ephraim? Well, two possible reasons. One, first of all, they're not in Har Ephraim anymore. We're north of Har Ephraim. So one way to think of Yoav framing this is, I need one guy, he's not even from your neighborhood. You know, he's a foreigner. He's not from your town, so you can give him up. The other way of, another way maybe of understanding what Yoav is doing here is the Mefarshim have a bit of a disagreement. Who lives in the city of Avel Beis Ma'acha? Right? We'll go back up to the map for a second to see where the territory is. And it's all the way in the north. This is the territory of Asher, right? So maybe familiar with the Medrash that the Isha Chachama who's talking to Yoav is Serach Bas Asher. Well, one reason why they're saying that is that we're in the territory of Asher. But some of the Mefarshim think that actually the people living in the city are from Shevet Binyamin. As we've seen before, people from Binyamin are kind of all over the area over here, going back to that time of Pelegesh Begiva. Some of them ended up in Yavesh Gilad, and some of them seem to end up in Machanaim. So apparently, some of the Farshim think that some of Shevet Binyamin also end up in Avel Beis Macha, all the way north over here. That would explain why Sheva ben Bichri, who is from Shevet Binyamin, is in this city in the first place. So if that's the case, then you could also think of Yoav talking to the woman over here. And he says, look, I'm not looking for somebody from Shevet Binyamin, i.e. somebody from your Shevet. I'm looking for somebody from Har Ephraim. You guys aren't from Har Ephraim. Okay, maybe he shares a Shevet with you, but you're Avel Beis Macha. He's Har Ephraim. He's not one of yours. Either way, you know, whether Yoav is just focusing on the geography, or whether maybe he's also trying to discount the Shevet connection, he's trying to make it easier for the city to disassociate themselves from Sheva ben Bichri. Give him to me, right? And then I will go away. And that's exactly what happens. Now, this is the exact playbook that Yoav did with Avshalom, where Yoav realized that if we just kill Avshalom, we don't need to fight the war. That was the exact playbook that Achitofel wanted Avshalom to use against David, where if he just kills David, we don't need to have the war. And just like the Navi was clearly supportive of Yoav's decision to do that against Avshalom, same exact thing is true over here. We just get rid of the one problematic person, and that's going to save everyone else. In fact, when in Halachas, Yerushalmi and Masechet Trumos, which talks about what to do when if a group of non-Jews says, you know, give one Jew over to be killed, or we'll kill all of you. So the halacha is if they do not identify the Jew, they say, you know, give up one or we'll kill all of you. So the halacha is Yeharig Val Yavor. We're not allowed to give over a Jew. If I single out one specific Jew, then it's a discussion in the Gemara. But the Gemara's example of when it's completely permissible is the Gemara says, if the person is Chai of Misa, if they identify somebody who is Chai of Misa, like Sheva ben Bichri, then that person you are allowed to hand over in order to save everybody else, right? If it is the guilt of that one individual, the community is not responsible to sacrifice itself for the guilt of an individual. The community is responsible to sacrifice itself for the life of an individual. So here we have Yoav saying, just give up Sheva ben Bichri, and then, okay, that happens. The Navi doesn't really tell us how it happened. The Navi just says, "Vatzavah Yisha al kol ha'am bechachmasa." Right. So it's not really clear what her chachma was exactly. I was trying to find it. One of the Mefarshim quotes, it looks like it must be Medrash. To be honest, I just haven't found it inside yet. This description of her having like an Avraham in Sodom kind of negotiation, where she comes back to them and she says, "Okay, Yoav wants the 500 heads of the rebellion to be killed." And like, what? We can't do that. And then she pretends to come back to Yoav and she negotiates to, you know, 100 to 50. And by the end, they're so relieved that it's like Sheva ben Bichri, they have no problem. But I wasn't able to find that in Medrash. I don't even remember which one of the Mefarshim mentioned it, I'll be honest. I looked at this like a week ago. The Radak, though, says, and I think this really fits with something I want to set up right after this. Radak says, what's the chachma? So he says, the fisha haisa ha'ir mibnei Binyamin. Now here's one of the Mefarshim who thinks that it is members of Binyamin who are living in Aval Beis Macha. Haisa tzricha leftosam midivrei chachama. So at the end of the day, they're loyal to their kinsmen. So she needs to use intelligence in order to get them to kill Shem. You might think it's a no-brainer, but if you have insight into how solidarities really can work and how loyalties can work, you can understand that this actually could have been a very delicate mission for her to pull on. And we'll really strengthen the Radak suggestion in just a second. Let's just finish the pasuk. So they throw Sheva's head over the wall. Vayiska b'shofar. So Yoav blows the horn. This is now the third time, right, that Yoav blows a shofar. Yoav is a general. But even that's part of the fascinating paradox of Yoav, right? He's a killer. We've seen him kill three people. We've seen him kill Avner. We've seen him kill Avshalom. We've seen him kill Amasa, different shades between white or gray or black, each one of those. So he's a killer. He's definitely a general and a fighter, but he's also a peacemaker, right? He tried to bring Avshalom back to David HaMelech. And three different times he blows the shofar to end the battle. He ended the battle with Avner and Perek Beis. He blew the shofar to end the battle with Avshalom and Perek Tibches. And now the third time he blows the shofar to end the battle in Perek Chaf. And then the great irony, Vayafutsu me'al ha'ir ishlo alav. Everyone goes back to his tent. What's ironic about this is that this was the battle cry of Sheva. Right? Sheva ben Bichri had said, ishlo alav Yisrael. He said, every man back to his tent, but abandoning the monarchy. Now what's actually happening is Yoav wins, and it is Yoav's victory. It is Yoav's stabilizing the Malchus that allows each person to go back to his tent in true peace and security. Yoav sham Yerushalayim, shav Yerushalayim, el hamalach. Yoav goes back to Yerushalayim, and Yoav goes back. But I think the really important point to draw out of Yoav and Sheva ben Bichri, especially the Radak's insight over here, that we might have thought that the B'nai Binyamin would have Yoav's back, is to think of the episode of Pilegesh Begiv, right? The nadir of Sefer Shoftim, especially as Abar Benel has suggested, that Sheva ben Bichri's whole goal was to restore the era of the Shoftim, right? Let's go back to Ein Melech B'Yisrael. Now, the whole beginning of Sefer Shmuel was trying to turn around from that rock bottom. But what happened there in the episode of Pilegesh Begiv? It was really something exceptionally similar. We had a few individual sinners, right? The other Shvatim sent to the tribe of Binyamin saying, give over those people. Ata tenu es ha'anashim b'nei Belial asher b'giva misein. Give over those b'nei Belial. The exact same term that the Navi used for Sheva ben Bichri. The Navi introduced him, remember, before we even found out his name. The Navi told us there's an Ish ben Belial who shmo Sheva ben Bichri. Well, we also have the original B'nai B'lial, who are the ones who raped the Pilegesh Begiva. So they tell Binyamin, give those over, and we can just handle the problem. But what happened? Instead, Binyamin insisted on protecting their own people, and that led to civil war. Right? So this has happened once before. You really can't appreciate the Radach has a great point. It did take some serious diplomacy to get Shevet Binyamin to give up their own, regardless of how bad he was, because we've seen this playbook in the past. Now, there's also kind of a similar line towards the end when the Isha Chachama tells Yoav, what was the exact line again that she said? Right, lama tivla ilhamis ir ba'ein b'Yisrael, lama tivla nachalas Hashem. Right, this like really principled language and dramatic language about destroying a city, destroying Hashem's nachala. No, we had very similar language used, and I only gave like one example of this, but the refrain happened a couple of times in Parak Kaf Aleph and Sefer Shoftim about why should we destroy a shevet in Bnei Yisrael after they're trying to build, bring back Shevet Binyamin that had been almost completely destroyed. So the callback to Pilegesh Begiva, right, I think really, it just fits very, very well with the point that Abar Benel is making. Sheva ben Bichri is arguing for a return to the Shoftim, but we know what that looks like, right? We know that the anarchy that he's calling for is not as nice as it actually seems. And Yoav's victory really plays out exactly the way we would have wanted the Pilegesh Begiva rebellion to work out. They do just execute the one sinner, and then everyone else is able to have peace, right? The truth is, the two stories end very similarly, but with one dramatic difference. And it's really, really important for putting a capstone on really the whole last few prakim of Sefer Shmuel. How did Pilegesh Begiva end? Once again, after the war and after what they did with the women of Yavesh Gilad, when they kind of kidnapped them and forced them to marry the men of Shevet Binyamin. So, you know, kind of began the story with a rape and the end of the story with a rape. So everyone goes back. Everyone goes back. So very similar to us, right? With us, everyone goes back to his tent. Here, everyone goes back to his family. But what's the huge difference? Say for Shoftim ended, so every man goes back to his family. Navi reminds us there is no king, i.e. the reason why things are as bad as they are is because there's no leadership. What happens with the end of Sheva ben Bichri and Yoav? Once again, right, each man goes back to his tent. However, Yoav shav Yerushalayim el Hamelach. Right, and the last word of this real narrative is the word Hamelach, that there is a king. And if we look at Batsheva and Uriah and Dov, right, it's like the classic way of presenting Sefer Shmuel is we want to see the corruptions of monarchy, right? And how, you know, the power can even can corrupt David HaMelech. You know, Shaul is the king and he's corrupted, and David is the king and he's corrupted. Ishbosheth, really, Avner is the king and there's a needless civil war.
and just a critique of monarchy. But I think if we look at between Avshalom and Sheva ben Bichri, which is really the punishment for David, right, the rebellions that he suffers in the aftermath, we appreciate that on the one hand, maybe that's true. I mean, right, the Navi definitely does want to show us we're not shying away from how the monarchy can corrupt, but you have to offer, what's the alternative? You know, this is kind of exactly the discussion that Shmuel and Hashem were having. Yeah, it's a problem they want a melech. We're going to give it to them because what do they want to have instead? The two extremes. There's the Avshalom extreme, who's the tyrant, right? So what, you have David with Bathsheba. Well, now you have Avshalom who does the exact same thing, except it's with 10 kilekshim, except it's out of one. Or the other extreme, you want to have Sheva ben Bichri, you want to have total anarchy. Well, we know what that road leads to. That leads to the world of Pilagesh Begiva. So there's no perfect answer to this. We have David the king, and the Navi shows us his mistakes. We have Yoav the general, and the Navi certainly shows us his mistakes. But that at the end of the day, as we finish the whole story and we look back on Sefer Shmuel, you know, we got more to go, but this is really the, like, the last few Prakma and Sefer Shmuel are just kind of attached toward the end pieces. This is like the real historical cap on David's career is this parak over here. And we take a look back and we understand it's a difficult world. There's no good answer. And with all the problems we saw with David and with Yoav, it seems to be a far better model with the two of them, you know, who at least there is leadership, there's strong leadership. And without the strong leadership and deterrence of Yoav, this, what would this have led to? It would have led to a terrible civil war. It was his compelling personality, his ability to fight, his ability to really intimidate that ended up bringing the whole army to him and stopping the war in its tracks at the cost of only one life. You need a Yoav. But then look at the dangers of that. Well, at least Yoav is able to recognize and take Musar and turn things around. And David is the same way. The two alternatives, you know, are even worse. And this is what Sefer Shmuel began with. You know, with when Shaul's monarchy began, and the Navi had extremely clear callbacks to Pilagesh Megiva, where he's bringing people back, both Shmuel and Shaul separately, bring people to the same place in Mitzvah, and then with the time that Shaul was cutting up the animal to send the pieces all around. You know, the Navi is not hiding at all from, we're not romantic at all about a world of the Shoftim looks like. As complicated as the Malchus can be, maybe it is the best alternative as we explore any other option, right? So Uri and Bathsheba shows us the corruption of even Malchus of David. Then between Avshalom and Sheva, we understand why this is exactly what we want to stick with, as long as you have the Navi who's available to correct and to be listened to. Okay, so we'll just, you know, wrap up the last couple of psukim, because it's the Navi then, really, this is the end of the, or seems to be the end of the Sheva narrative. The Navi then tells us, "V'Yoav el kol tzava Yisrael." So Yoav is the head of the general, is the head of the army, and then we're told about a few different people. Benayahu, who is an important Sefer Malachim, so he's the head of the palace guard, the crazy place. Then we have a few different people, the tax collector, Adoram, the recorder, the scribe, the Kohanim. Okay, and somebody who seems to be the Kohen of David, who's like David's advisor. So why is this here? So Rashi says that it's really just there to let us know about what happens in the aftermath. Rashi says, read this after the Sheva rebellion. The Navi wants to know that Yoav is back in charge of the army. Alpha Pishamar David al Amasa Kisar Tzva, right? He was gonna make Amasa the general. But Yoav kind of ruined that plan. So now Yoav is a general. Okay, why do we mention the rest of the cabinet? So Rashi says, Al Yidei Yoav Huskak Limno says Chavei Rav. Well, since we mentioned Yoav, we also need to mention everyone else. So that's one way to read the end of the parak over here. It's a continuation of the Sheva rebellion. We should know Yoav regains his place as the general. And once we mention that, we should just mention a few other officials. Radakto points out that this is not the first time that we've seen the Navi mention David's cabinet. So
Radak says, right, he says, Malakasuv Gamkin Mispar Sarim Ashelo, Kishniach Lo Hashem Yikol Hamlachamos. After all the wars against the foreign powers, the Navi told us David's cabinet. So he says, the same thing is happening here. The Navi tells us the cabinet as a way of telling us that peace has been regained, and it's as if the kingdom has been renewed, right? David basically lost the Malucha with the rebellions of Absalom and Shad, and then Sheva ben Bichri. So the way the Navi tells us that things have been restored, everything has come full circle, is that we're now back to having reestablished David in Yerushalayim, and let's go through his capital. I just want to point out that there are a couple of differences, and it's interesting to see them, wondering how maybe things have changed. Maybe for better, maybe for worse. Maybe things have just changed from the early years of David's Malchus. Perek Ches, so we also had some of the same people. So at the beginning we had David, who's Oseh Mishpat Tzedakah L'chol Amo, and you have Yoav ben Tzruya on the army. Chazal are very excited about that. They said that David and Yoav were able to work in tandem. But there were some changes. So the Radak points out one change. There was no tax collector in Perek Ches. Now this Adoram, the tax collector, appears in Perek Chaf. So, and he's going to stick around. He's going to be the tax collector for Shlomo, and he's going to get stoned to death in the beginning of the reign of Rechavam, because people don't like the IRS. So the Radak might say, yeah, apparently David had to raise taxes on Bnei Yisrael. It wasn't true in the early years, but as the kingdom becomes more established, a tax system is necessary. Well, we can understand then why rebellion would be likely. We can understand why there'd be the appeal of an Avshalom or the appeal of a Sheva ben Bichri. A couple of other changes here is that who were the Kohanim in Perek Ches? Bnei David Kohanim Hayu. Right? David's sons seem to have had very important positions. That is gone in our Perek. We have Ira ha-ya-iri, but David's sons seem like they're basically fired. Having had Amnon not work out and having had Avshalom not work out, so David seems to have removed political power from his sons. That's just an interesting thing to think about for how Sefer Malachim is going to begin with the rebellion of Adonijo, because presumably David's son's not very happy with that. But this could be seen in a positive light. Right, you have the favoritism and the nepotism of the sons. So now David, as things are going, is isolating that, and he's making things more official. Just because you're a son of David doesn't mean you're necessarily a great candidate to be an advisor, to be a minister. Instead, it's being more professionalized. And the last, what was the last change that over here? Oh yeah, right. So this is a little bit depressing, but Yav has the army, and Benayah ben Yoyada has the crazy in the place. Right? Benayah ben Yoyada has the palace guard. Back in Parakles, that was at the very end. Benayah ben Yoyada had the crazy in the place. That was all. That Yav was in the beginning, and then we had everyone else, and Benayah at the end. And it seems like as David's reign gets, as things go on, and David is not able to mingle with the people to the same degree. The security regime, when you've had two rebellions against you, is not the same as it was before then. The crazy in the place, you take on more importance. Also notice that the Navi does not present David as Oseh Mishpatot Tzedakah L'chol Amo. It seems like there is more distance between David and the people. So we may get the sense that as things go on the one hand, like the Radak says, there's a renewal over here. There's a restoration of peace. And that's why we go through the cabinet. Right? At the same time, in certain ways, things have gone more positive. How we've shifted from the advisors just being the Bnei David to being a more professional system. And at the same time, things are more complicated. We need to have a tax system. That wasn't there before. Now we need to have it. But also, it seems like there may be some more distance between David and the people. And we need the crazy in the place of the palace guard and David not being so directly involved. Okay, so that was Perek Chaf. So we'll start back next week. Really, it's a total change of pace next week with Perek Chaf. The rest of the Sefer is going to be just like assorted stuff. I'm not totally sure how we'll tackle it, but we can figure that out. So we'll definitely do that. Next week we'll meet regular time. Okay. Okay.